It's Here and Now. I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. A record number of homes were lost to foreclosure in the first 3 months of the year. RealtyTrack reports that the number of homes taken over by banks jumped 35% in the first quarter of 2010 compared to last year. And the company predicts 1 million homes will be lost to foreclosure this year. The Obama administration had hoped to slow the rate of foreclosures through a $75 billion loan modification program. But so far, it's only helped about 230,000 people out of the 4 million who were targeted for help. For more on these latest numbers, we turn to Stella Hopkins of the Charlotte Observer. Stella, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, why are we seeing this huge increase in foreclosures right now?
Well, unemployment just continues stubbornly high, you know, 9.7% for the nation, so awful close to 1 out of 10. And here in the Charlotte area, we're at nearly 13%, and we've been in that double-digit state for more than a year. Until we see job growth, foreclosures will continue. We are also likely seeing what I have thought of as kind of the pig in the python working through, foreclosures that were delayed by moratoria, new state laws, modification efforts, public outcry. They're now working their way through the system.
We mentioned that the Obama administration's $75 billion foreclosure prevention program helped about 230,000 people. But another 158,000 homeowners who signed up for the program initially dropped out of it after a while. Do we know why?
Certainly some issues are that they did not make payments, that they failed to return necessary documents, or as I hear constantly from the dozens of people who call me every week, their documents were lost. I will say that Bank of America, in congressional testimony last week, said that they have 380,000 customers that haven't returned the documents they need just to start the process, to make an offer.
This week, Elizabeth Warren, head of the Congressional Oversight Panel, said that the U.S. Treasury is lagging behind the pace of this crisis. How would you say the Obama administration needs to respond to that criticism?
Part of the problem is that some people simply can't afford to stay in their homes. That message has come through from various parts of the administration. I think the more underlying problem is that the modification program, HAMP, was intended to help the problem with exotic, crazy, armed, subprime problems, to save families' homes by reducing interest rates, putting people in affordable mortgages. It can work well for those people or for people who have suffered income declines. Unfortunately, almost as soon as HAMP came along, unemployment had become the big foreclosure driver, and it is very hard to modify a loan for someone with no income.
Well, let's talk about the Obama administration's plans to revamp the foreclosure program to help the unemployed, to encourage lenders to cut the loan balances of borrowers who are underwater, that is, people whose homes are worth less now than their mortgages. You report that program won't necessarily help the unemployed as much as originally thought, right?
Well, for sure, there's a short-term benefit. 3 months of lower payments based on your unemployment income. But there's just widespread agreement that while that's nice, it's just way too little in an economy that has 6.3 million people who have been out of work for more than 6 months. And beyond that short-term help, homeowners will no longer be able to qualify for a modification based only on unemployment income.
Based in Charlotte, Stella, you have a front row seat to how some of the big banks are dealing with foreclosures. You mentioned Bank of America. Can you give us a sense of how that bank, for one, is responding generally?
Yeah, I think that while everybody was pretty slow to get off the ground, including Bank of America on this modification thing, they really seem to be pulling out in front and revealing a lot of detail about the magnitude of the problem. For example, this week they said that they have hundreds of thousands of customers who haven't made a payment in more than a year, and they're fielding more than 125,000 calls per day from struggling borrowers. So in response, some of the things they've done, also under heavy criticism and facing a number of lawsuits, they've recently pledged to speed response to customers, and they are offering more support for writing down principal for delinquent customers who are, as we said, underwater.
B of A is doing it. Why aren't more banks willing to reduce reduce the principal on their customers' mortgages. I mean, it seems it would be cheaper for a bank to lower the principal than to put a home in foreclosure.
Well, it is cheaper than a foreclosure in a lot of situations, but it's more expensive than a modification with, say, an interest rate reduction. Now, in all fairness, most banks do have offerings of principal reduction. The concern is, you know, this sort of broader blanket. The issue is the fear that customers who are current but underwater will be upset and potentially stop making payments. And I can see people being upset, but I don't see a big rush to become delinquent, in part because it won't help if you cannot pass the hardship test, if you cannot prove, for example, that you lost your job, that you've had a huge reduction in income. You still are not going to get that principal reduction. It is for delinquent customers who are in danger of losing their homes.
Realty Track predicts, Stella, that 1 million homes will be lost to foreclosure this year. Do you see that happening, or is there anything on the horizon that might slow that down?
If we get jobs. Without jobs, I don't see a big slowdown in foreclosures. I think it goes on and continues to play out and glut the market with inventory this year and probably further into the future. I mean, as it trickles down further and further through the system, people have to have jobs.
Stella Hopkins of the Charlotte Observer talking to us about the latest foreclosure numbers from Realty Track. Stella, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
When the oldest and longest-serving member of the U.S. Supreme Court retires this summer, he sets the stage for a fight between liberals and conservatives for the future of the court. While Senate Democrats hold a 59-vote majority, Republicans have not ruled out an attempt to delay confirmation. John Paul Stevens is considered the liberal lion of the court, one of its most diligent workers, thoughtful writers, and probing questioners. His absence will certainly change the dynamic of the court. Joining us to sort it all out today is Jeffrey Toobin. He's staff writer with The New Yorker magazine, senior legal analyst for CNN, and author of The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. His profile of Justice Stevens appears in a recent issue of The New Yorker magazine. Welcome, Jeffrey. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
Before we talk about who's being considered for the soon-to-be-vacant Supreme Court seat, let's talk about the process of confirmation. It's clear President Obama will look for who he thinks is the best candidate, but also who's the most confirmable candidate, right? Is confirmability the issue when it comes to replacing Justice Stevens?
Well, I think it's a package of concerns. This is a decision that any president takes very seriously. You know, as we know, presidents serve for 4 or 8 years, but Supreme Court justices serve for decades, so this will be an important part of President Obama's legacy. He's going to want someone who is who reflects Obama's own views on the Constitution, and as a former law professor himself, he has a lot of them. And of course, he'll want someone who can be confirmed. But with 59 Democrats, that's a very substantial majority. And you know, barring some outlandish choice or a scandal, he's likely to have a pretty free hand.
What are some of the issues, Jeffrey, that conservatives are likely to scrutinize in a candidate?
Well, I think the overall ideological profile will be the concern. There's a lot of rhetoric about things like judicial activism, but there is just as much judicial activism on the right as there is on the left. You know, I think the concerns very much track Democratic and Republican positions on issues. Where does the person stand on abortion, on affirmative action, on gun control, on the power of the federal government when it comes to health care? These are all the issues that will be of concern to both sides. Whether the hearings are illuminating at all of the nominee's views, that's a separate question, and I don't have very high hopes.
Let's take a look at the list of candidates under consideration, Jeffrey. The latest information says there are about 10 of them, with a short list of 3 or 4. Let's begin with Solicitor General Elena Kagan. She's a former dean of Harvard Law School. What do you know about her?
Well, she's 49 years old. She was also a law school classmate of mine, so I have known her for a very long time. And I have to confess I'm a friend of hers, so you can discount what I say
accordingly. Full disclosure, yes.
She is someone who built a reputation as a consensus builder at Harvard Law School, which was a very polarized place. She has good relationships with conservatives there. She was an aide in Bill Clinton's White House. She was deputy domestic and policy advisor there. Close ties to Democrats. Not a very long paper trail. Her record on constitutional issues is something of a mystery to Democrats and Republicans alike. But she appears to be a moderate Democrat. She's been a successful Solicitor General in a relatively brief tenure there. She seems to be a good advocate in front of the Supreme Court. But in terms of a record of what she stands for, there's not a lot there, which makes both the left and the right kind of nervous.
And what about Federal Appeals Court Judge Diane Wood? There must be a paper trail there. She's worked at the Antitrust Department during the Clinton administration. At one point, she worked with President Obama, didn't she?
She did. She also was on the faculty of the University of Chicago Law School when Obama taught part-time there. She has been an appeals court judge for almost 15 years, so she is very much an experienced judge. She's a little older. Kagan is 49. Wood is 59, and age is a factor in Supreme Court appointments because presidents want long tenures. She at least has the reputation of being somewhat more liberal, perhaps, than some of the other choices, although I would really caution people about assuming too much. You know, appeals court judges are fundamentally bound by precedent in a way that Supreme Court justices are not. So, yes, she's had a few decisions where she was outvoted by some of her very conservative colleagues on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. But, you know, whether there is a substantial ideological difference between her and the other possible nominees is, to me, a very open question.
Many are saying that the safer choice, perhaps the safest, is the former Clinton administration official and federal appeals court judge Merrick Garland. In our last minute here before the break, Jeffrey, what do you think of Merrick?
D.C. Circuit judge, very experienced, very solid in his judicial record. Again, seems to be a moderate Democrat, but you know, these precise ideological distinctions that some people are drawing, I'm very skeptical about. I think you really can't know what the differences is besides sort of broad strokes. And in broad strokes, all the nominees are pretty similar, prospective nominees.
Is the president likely to favor a man, a woman, this time around? Is that a consideration?
You know what? I think that's kind of an antique consideration. There could easily be three women on the court. You know, half the law students in this country are women. The idea that two is somehow a ceiling, I think, is really obsolete.
And timetable for nomination, Jeffrey?
I think there will be a nominee by the first half of May. Which would give the Senate plenty of time to hold hearings over the summer and have the justice in place by the first Monday in October, the start of its year.
We're speaking with Jeffrey Toobin of The New Yorker magazine about possible replacements for retiring Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. We'll have more with him in a minute. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. We've been speaking with Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, about the upcoming retirement of Justice John Paul Stevens and the possible candidates to replace him. Regardless of disagreement about who should fill the seat, there is wide agreement that it is quite a space to fill. Stevens is known as a reflective justice, an articulate speaker, a meticulous writer, and a thoughtful questioner. He was also the last justice to serve in the Second World War, an experience which he and others say helped inform his decision-making and identity as an American. Jeffrey Toobin, you recently spent some time with Justice Stevens, who turns 90 years old next week, and you write that even if President Obama appointed a like-minded replacement for Stevens, that person, while taking his seat, would not fill his role. What is Stevens' current role on the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, he is the senior associate justice, which means he has been an associate justice longer than anyone else, and quite a bit longer. He was appointed by President Ford in 1963. 75, and the next most senior justice is Antonin Scalia, who was appointed by President Reagan 11 years later. So he has just been on the court a lot longer than anyone else. But more importantly, he is the senior liberal on the court, and he has been responsible for trying to wrangle votes for quite some time, and he has been pretty successful on a very polarized court. He has engineered several important victories for liberals, even though there are really only four liberals on the court. He has managed to bring along Justice Anthony Kennedy on occasion. Earlier, he brought along Justice O'Connor, and the ability to mobilize and bring together five votes is something he seems to have done very well. And whether his successors can do it is very much an open question.
We'll speak more to his style, being successful on a polarized court. You say he's never the first person to ask a question on the bench, and when he does, he tends to start with phrases like, "May I ask you a question?" He is fully a gentleman.
I think that speaks to his Midwestern reserve. He's from Chicago, still got a bit of Midwestern accent, and he's just a very polite person. But there is a method to his questioning, because the court is curious in many respects, but the justices don't talk to each other very much. It's really nine separate law firms, and oral argument is really the only chance the justices have each other as a captive audience until they sit down to vote. So it's smart to listen to your colleagues and use your questions as a form of advocacy, and he certainly does that a lot, and that's why he takes a while to wade into these arguments, because he wants to hear what his colleagues' considerations are about any given case.
John Paul Stevens is the final sitting Supreme Court justice to have served in the Second World War, which you say has shaped his perspective on decisions related to the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as past decisions like flag burning, for example. What will be lost with that perspective?
Oh, it's really a major moment in American history when you think about it, because it really was for decades that World War II veterans dominated our public life. President Kennedy, George Herbert Walker Bush. It was a matter of course that the men, and it was mostly men, who fought in World War II would become civic leaders. Stevens is really the last one, and whether it was his truly heartfelt patriotism, which was reflected in his vote, an uncharacteristic vote, many people feel, that said flag burning was not protected by the First Amendment. He lost that case. Mm-hmm. But perhaps more importantly, his victories in all the Guantanamo cases, where he led the liberals to success in striking down repeatedly how the Bush administration was handling the detainees in Guantanamo, it showed a level of self-confidence about military matters that other justices just don't have. He was an intelligence officer in World War II. He was a codebreaker based at Pearl Harbor. And, he has an understanding of military intelligence in a way that his colleagues just could not possibly. And I think that's made a difference.
One of Justice Stevens' best-known dissents was actually written recently, the Citizens United decision, which ruled that corporations can donate to political campaigns in the same way as individuals can. You write, Jeffrey, that one of the problems Stevens had with the decision was that it was ruled so broadly. What did you mean by that, and what was Stevens actually worried about?
Well, the specific Citizens United case dealt with whether the FCC could regulate an obscure nonprofit called Citizens United in making available a movie critical of Hillary Clinton on a technology called video on demand that's hardly ever used. That decision could have been made in many ways that were quite narrow. You could have said it doesn't apply to nonprofits, the McCain-Feingold campaign law. It doesn't apply to video on demand. But instead, the Supreme Court used this case to say that all corporations and all nonprofits and all labor unions are free to try to influence the outcome of elections without any kind of restrictions. That's a very broad ruling. And Stevens comes from a tradition where judges shouldn't decide more than they have to decide a case before them. And I think that is an example of how the current conservative majority is, in fact, quite judicially active itself, very much composed of judicial activists who want to use their enormous power to change the law and change society more than any case should ordinarily allow them to do.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer with The New Yorker magazine, senior legal analyst for CNN, author of The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the U.S. Supreme Court. Jeffrey, great to speak with you again. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, Jane.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, paying students to excel in school. Is it a bribe? Is it a reward? Does it work? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, your tax dollars at work. News is next, Here and Now. One of the ironies of the continued building of Jewish settlements in the West Bank is that thousands of the construction workers are Palestinians. The reason? It's a matter of dollars and cents. The Palestinians say they need the jobs to support their families. Now the Palestinian Authority is considering a ban on Palestinian construction workers in the settlements by the end of the year. The workers say such a ban would be a crippling economic blow. Builders say if they're forced to hire other workers, the price of settlement housing will go up. From the West Bank, the BBC's Middle East correspondent Tim Franks reports.
This is the settlement of Har Giloh between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. Despite the Israeli government's declaration of a curb on settlement building, there's plenty of construction going on. Naja Saadi operates a pile driver. He's worked in this settlement 5 days a week for the last 2 years, commuting from his home in Ramallah.
I want to earn money to live. We don't have any work in Palestinian areas, and so we're forced to work for the Jews.
There's talk in the PA of passing a law to stop Palestinians from working in the settlements. What do you think about that?
They cannot do that. They cannot prevent us from working here. If they don't want people to work on the settlements, they should invest in us.
A little further down the road, Ilya Siditsky is poring over plans with a Palestinian worker to build a sales room for the 18 cottages he's planning to start constructing here in the next few months. All his builders, he says, will be Palestinians from the West Bank.
I think the simple worker is hungry for work. They want to work, and usually they're very professional.
If you couldn't get those Palestinians, would you be able to find workers from elsewhere? Would you use foreign workers?
The price of new apartments will go up because we will have to employ workers from Jerusalem.
It's difficult to know precisely how many Palestinians work as builders in the 100 or so Jewish settlements like this one across the West Bank. One estimate puts it at around 30,000. Now those workers are coming up against an increasingly concerted campaign led by the Palestinian Authority against the settlements. The PA already holds regular bonfires and demolitions, such as this one, of commercial produce from settlements. The sound you're hearing is of a front-loader tractor crushing food and drinks seized from Palestinian shops and warehouses in the West Bank. And now senior officials at the Palestinian Authority say that come the end of the year, Palestinians will no longer be allowed to work in the settlements, despite the considerable economic pain this might cause. Hassan Abu Libdeh is the Palestinian economics minister.
The process we are embarked on is a process that will clean the Palestinian economy and the Palestinian society from any association with settlements. At some stage, probably in a matter of a year, Palestinians will find it difficult to work in settlements because they will be violating the law.
And what do you say to those Palestinians currently working on those settlements who say, look, we're not here with a glad heart, but we're here because there aren't any jobs in the West Bank for us?
I believe it is a shame for any Palestinian to be part of the lifeline of settlement activities. No Palestinian should be part of this.
It could be a very controversial move. All the Palestinian construction workers I've spoken to over the years in Jewish settlements say that they're there only reluctantly, but that they have families to support. The signs here in Ramallah are that their plea for special dispensation is about to be spurned.
That report from Tim Franks, the BBC's Middle East correspondent. Up next, on this tax day, how much of your tax dollar goes toward medical care or national security? We'll tell you. You're listening to Here and Now. If you're not square with Uncle Sam, today is the day. All year, Americans have been paying taxes on their income, property, and purchases, and most of us have a pretty good idea how much tax we owe. But how many people know exactly what we're paying for? When the money magically disappears from our check, what happens to it? Politicians are keen to use the phrase, your tax dollars, when lobbying for or against legislation, public services, and wars. But it's not often clear how much they're talking about. Joining us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington, D.C. is Bill Ahern. He's a spokesperson for the nonpartisan tax research group, the Tax Foundation. Bill, welcome to Here and Now.
Good afternoon, Jane.
I want to be as straightforward as possible here. So let's start with federal taxes, which are primarily collected through income. And instead of talking about billions and trillions of dollars, let's keep it simple. And say someone pays $1 in federal income tax. How does the federal government spend that $1?
Most of the money is transferred to other people to pay for their health care or their retirement. What the federal government calls entitlements. Roughly 56 cents of that tax dollar that you send in goes out in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and other smaller but still huge health and income security programs.
And Bill, what about defense and security?
Defense is about 20 cents of your tax dollar and is the next biggest chunk after that big 56-cent entitlement chunk. And the rest is kind of dribs and drabs, you know, 3 cents of your dollar on education, 2 cents of your dollar on transportation, and 1.5 cents on housing and other things. But those two, defense, 20 cents, and entitlements, 56 cents, those are the ones that are driving federal taxes.
So how much do we pay to keep the U.S. government operating? Congressional paychecks, you know, electricity at the Capitol, fuel for Air Force One. How much for all that?
Oh, that would be less than 1%. The bare bones of government operation. Not that federal employees are low paid or anything. It's just that in comparison to the vast fiscal flows out in entitlement, those keeping the lights on dollars are pretty small.
The public service operations, however, like the FDA, the EPA, services for veterans, that's a hefty chunk, 19%, no?
Now, each one of, if you added up a whole bunch of miscellaneous departments like that, it might add up to that. But in most cases, each of those things that you mentioned is really only 1 or 2%.
So entitlements and defense and security, really the top things that we're paying for when we shut out federal government taxes.
That's right. Your 1040 is pretty much devoted to those things. But what we're sending in with our 1040 today, or if you've done it earlier, is not really even close to covering what we're spending on those things, and that's the deficit, what we're not collecting but what we are spending, which is bigger this year than it's ever been.
Let's talk about the national debt, because it's not often top of mind for a lot of people, but our taxes are not actually paying the debt. We're paying interest on the debt, right? So it's like a credit card requiring a minimum monthly payment?
That's right. And right now, the federal debt is up over $10 trillion, approaching $12 or $13 trillion, and the interest on that debt is inching up. According to the president's budget, if we do the things that he wants done, and as outlined in his budget in February, 10 cents of our tax dollars will just go on interest on the debt.
We've heard a lot recently from politicians and pundits, maybe more than usual, about how our tax dollars are spent with the health care reform bill, which actually has not taken effect yet, and things like last year's big bank bailout, often called the taxpayer bailout. So right there, a layperson might think, well, I'm paying more taxes for these things and less for other programs. Is that true, Bill?
No. We're spending more on other programs than we ever did. We just aren't collecting taxes to do so. We are borrowing to do so, more than half of which comes from foreign investors. And there's some concern in Washington about that's getting out of control, too.
What about state taxes? That's a completely different matter. State taxes are collected in a variety of ways, through property tax, through sales tax, and often they're collected out of necessity because not all states collect income taxes. So without running down all 50 states, what can you tell us about how our state tax dollars are being spent?
Sure. What those monies are going to is largely public education and health and hospitals and transportation. So, for example, of a dollar that you send to your state capital, public welfare is a category that would take 15 cents. That would be Medicaid spending largely. And education, the public school system, would be 30 cents. And then health and hospitals is the next at 7 cents. So that's about half of your dollar. Health and hospitals, Medicaid, and public education. Of course, public safety, that's about 8 cents of your state and local tax dollar. And there are a variety of things that take about 5 or 4 cents of your dollar, government administration, housing, environmental work, etc. And it all adds up. But education and health dominate the scene at the state and local level.
Nearly every state is struggling to balance their budgets, as you well know, something they're required to do by law, which, by the way, the federal government is not. States have raised various taxes.
Right.
Will people feel that burden on their tax return, especially this year?
Most of those taxes have come on the very poor and the very rich. That is, states have largely focused their tax increases on cigarettes, which is mostly the vice of the poor, and on high wages, which most of them chose as a threshold to impose higher rates, $200,000 for a household. So a lot of people around the country who are earning a lot are paying a lot more to their state capitals, and a lot of people who smoke, and roughly 23% of the country smokes, and most of those people are poor, they've been paying a lot because there's been a whole flurry of tobacco tax increases this year.
Have federal tax brackets moved around yet? Has the tax burden changed on any level with the new administration?
No. A lot of people thought that President Obama might come into office and the first thing he might do would be to rescind the Bush tax cuts. But he didn't. He left them in place and they dropped again in 2010. And that's the final year of the Bush tax cuts. So at the end of this year, on December 31st, they're all scheduled to expire and revert to their Clinton-era rates. And it's a matter of some debate in Washington how many of them will be allowed to expire.
Bill Ahern is spokesperson for the nonpartisan tax research group, the Tax Foundation, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
The days of kids will be kids appear to be over. These days, there's a movement afoot to have kids achieve at the same level as adults, and not just regular adults, super adults. And kids are expected to do it all before they even hit high school. Among their feats of daring include transatlantic sailing voyages, solo piloting, and now summiting Mount Everest. 13-year-old Jordan Romero is now on his way to base camp and blogging all the way in an attempt to become the youngest person ever to summit the world's tallest peak. The previous record is held by a 15-year-old who lost 5 fingers in the process. It's important to note that summiting Mount Everest is not for the faint of heart. 1 out of every 30 people who has tried has died. Some years that tally has risen to as high as 1 in 8. The air during the final trek to the peak contains 30% less oxygen than at sea level, and climbers are subject to frostbite, pulmonary edema, altitude sickness, and ultimately death by any number of accidents. In fact, the final ascent requires climbing through a virtual cemetery with failed climbers' bodies scattering the ice fields below. Outside Magazine writer Bruce Barcott spent time with teen climber Jordan Romero and wrote about it in this month's magazine. The article is titled Into Teen Air. Bruce, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about Jordan Romero. Mount Everest is hardly his first feat of mountain climbing, is it?
It's not. Jordan's a great kid. He's 13 years old, lives in a small mountain town outside of Los Angeles called Big Bear. And Mount Everest is actually, I think, number six on his quest to climb the seven summits, which are the seven highest peaks on each continent. He started a few years ago just as a lark. He noticed a mural painted on the wall of his elementary school that had the seven summits on it, and started to get interested, and mentioned it to his father. And his father and his father's partner happened to be professional adventure racers. So the more they started talking about it, the more they thought, you know, this is something that we might actually be able to do.
Do you believe that this Everest attempt was entirely his own idea, a 13-year-old's idea, no pressure at all from a father who's a very experienced climber himself?
That was a big question going into this piece. And, you know, after spending a number of days with him down there, I really honestly believe that this is something that Jordan does want to do with all his heart. You know, he really comes home after school every day and trains hard to do it. And I think he really does enjoy both the training and the mountain climbing aspect of it. I guess the deeper question then becomes, if it really is Jordan's quest and he does want to do this, you know, at what point does a parent step in and say, well, you know, that's a great goal and you should go after that, but it's something that, you know, you might want to work up to in your teens and maybe go after in your early 20s when you have a little bit more experience.
Well, tell us about some of the obstacles that a 13-year-old will face climbing Mount Everest.
There have been, you know, over the last few years, a sort of a steady down-ratcheting of the age at which people are accomplishing what are sort of considered monster feats in the world of adventure. Last year we had three 17-year-olds climbing on Mount Everest, and two of them made it to the summit. And Jordan's attempt really marks an interesting leap from the age of 17 down to 13. We're seeing the same thing going on in solo sailing. Last year there were two 17-year-olds who sailed solo around the world, and then a 13-year-old tried to do it, Laura Dekker from the Netherlands, but she was actually blocked by a Dutch court from setting sail. They thought she was too young to do it. So one of the questions is, you know, what's the difference between 17 and 13? Is there all that big a leap? And, you know, investigating that question in the article, I found that, you know, physically there may not be all that many obstacles that a 13-year-old will face as opposed to a 17-year-old. But mentally, the difference is enormous.
You quote some pretty experienced guides in your piece, Bruce, who have not only said they would not guide a child that young up Mount Everest, but have further said that they would not want their teams attempting a summit on the same day. What are their concerns in all this?
It's not so much that, you know, the 13-year-old physically can't handle it. It's that, you know, does he have the experience to know how to handle himself when a bad weather front moves in, when his body starts to be racked by altitude and just simple physical fatigue and low temperatures that he'll encounter up there. The other thing that's involved is really, you know, if a 13-year-old gets into trouble up there, boy, there's going to be a lot of pressure on everyone to come in and rescue that person.
And Jordan's family is not going with a guide, is that correct?
That's one of the most controversial aspects of his climb, is that all other teenagers who have gone up Everest have gone with very experienced guides leading them on the rope. And Jordan's family has elected not to go with a guide, and that really increases the risk up there. One of the ways that it increases the risk is when you have an experienced guide who's been up Everest 7, 8, 9, 10 times, that guide can see whether you as a climber are climbing strong, whether you're going to be able to make it up to the top and all the way back down. And in fact, we had a guide last year who turned around a 17-year-old client and said, you know, you're not climbing strong enough. I've seen this before, and if we go much higher, there's going to be trouble. And Jordan doesn't have that on his rope. You know, his father is very experienced as an adventure racer, but he's not that experienced in the high Himalayas. That is a real concern over there.
So his dad has never reached Everest himself?
No, he's never been on the summit.
A columnist for the Canadian magazine Maclean's writes that the real horror here, quote, is that if Jordan summits and returns alive, he will have set a benchmark that some other kid, i.e. parent, will try to break. and then someone else, and then someone else after that. What's your response to that? I mean, is the media attention and the adulation that Jordan is going to receive if he succeeds actually setting the stage for some sort of later tragedy?
That's an absolutely accurate concern, and I share it. You know, and even as I speak, you know, even as I wrote that article, I'm aware of my own role in setting that benchmark. I really don't like the idea of a youngest person record. It's a real problem, and the main reason is because if you set something at age 13, it is going to be attempted by somebody at age 12. But the problem is, especially in mountain climbing, you have to have the ability to turn around and go back down and retreat from a mountain if weather runs in or your physical abilities fall short. You know, Ed Veister is the great American climber, has climbed all 14 8,000-meter peaks without oxygen, and it took him years to do it because he turned around on a number of peaks. If you're 12 and you want to break Jordan Romero's record, you really don't have that option. You know, you don't have another year to come back because time marches on. The other thing that's sort of a ghost hanging over all of this is back in the 90s, about 15 years ago, we went through a similar thing with flying, and there was a tragic example of a girl named Jessica Dubroff back in the mid-90s who was a 7-year-old who wanted to break the record, be the youngest person to fly cross-country. Well, she made it about 3 days into her trip. She crashed the plane and killed everyone aboard, and that was the point at which, you know, a great heartwarming story about a plucky 7-year-old turned into a story about, you know, what idiots let a 7-year-old fly a plane.
You end your story, Bruce, on a fairly positive note. You praise Jordan Romero for his drive, for his maturity. You write, "Jordan Romero is an amazing, inspiring kid. He's everything you'd want in a rope partner, except one thing. He's 13. How do you see all this ending?
I hope it ends well, but I hope also that maybe we find a way to stop the downratcheting of the age in these places.
Outside magazine writer Bruce Barcott. His piece is titled Into Teen Air. Bruce has written about a 13-year-old Jordan Romero who is attempting to climb Mount Everest. Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.